Good afternoon. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you've been to a science fiction movie lately, you may have noticed a trend. Science fiction stories are looking more like the real world than ever before. Elizabeth Alsop has noticed that as well, and she wrote an article that appeared in the May issue of Atlantic, The Future Is Now. And she joins me this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show to talk about science fiction and what it looks like these days, and perhaps more importantly, why. Before we get to that, though, I want to invite you to join our discussion and answer the question, what particular science fiction stories do you feel we're living today? Are there any sci-fi books, films, or television shows you watch and wonder if they're real? And how do you think science fiction writing has changed over the years? 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the one you're used to. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. And, of course, you can always find The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Elizabeth Alsop is Assistant Professor of English and Film at Western Kentucky University. And her work has appeared in the Quarterly Review of Film and Video. She's also written essays on film, television, and popular culture for The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, The Los Angeles Review of Books, The Chronicle of Higher Education, and others. Her current book project examines the evolving function of dialogue within the Anglo-American modernist novel. Elizabeth Alsop, welcome to The Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
Well, I must confess that I probably haven't kept up as much as I should on recent science fiction film, but I do read a lot of science fiction books, and so your article particularly interested me. You wrote that contemporary science fiction, and I'll quote here, has drifted toward plausibility and familiarity. What do you mean by that? Give us some examples.
Well, you know, the sort of genesis of this article came a couple years ago, and I happened to be watching the British science fiction show Black Mirror right after I'd finished reading Dave Eggers' novel, The Circle. And, you know, one's a novel, one's a TV show, but they both struck me as just being terrifyingly plausible in their themes and situations. And so really what I meant by that is just this idea that you know, as we look at, again, shows like Black Mirror, also Orphan Black, novels like The Circle, I'm also thinking here of a novel like Claire V. Aitken's Gold Dust Citrus, and then also films like Ex Machina and Her, that these are narratives that are really imagining a kind of world that seems remarkably similar to our own rather than totally alien and far out.
So how are they still science fiction? The idea of science fiction is, at least as I've understood it, perhaps misunderstood it would be a better word, is we imagine something is going to happen or could possibly happen. We might create an entirely different universe or just take our story and set it someplace in a galaxy far, far away. How does this fit into the science fiction genre then, if it's so real?
That's a really great question. I'm thinking here as you were talking about Margaret Atwood, who is of course both a sort of practitioner of the genre and a theorist of it. And in I think a book that she wrote about science fiction, she actually talked about the genre as fiction in which things happen that are not possible today. But, you know, I think sort of the implication there is they might imagine things that are possible tomorrow or maybe 20 years from tomorrow. So it may actually be kind of an issue of temporality, and that some of the sci-fi media we're seeing now is just sort of instead of imagining, something many years from now, may actually just be interested in exploring a more proximate moment or a familiar world.
Do you think that the science fiction, not just movies but literature that we're seeing today, is darker than what we're used to seeing? And I'm thinking about the fact that almost all of these movies posit some sort of really dystopian future, even if it's the near future, or it's pretty depressing stuff in some regard. Is that a trend?
Yeah. I mean, I would say so, and I don't know if it means maybe that I'm watching particularly sort of, I'm drawn towards the darker and pessimistic, but certainly I think, and again, Black Mirror is a show that comes to mind. A lot of the scenarios that are played out in its episodes are really, I think, kind of like the worst case, kind of examples of what could happen if the sort of technological trajectories we're on continue. So just to give listeners sort of one example, if they haven't seen the show, one episode imagines a future in which everyone has kind of a wearable technology sort of implanted just behind their ear that allows them to record every single waking moment they have and to play it back at will. That sounds kind of, interesting in theory, but in practice it turns out to be disastrous. And watching that, you really can't help but think that, we already have things like Fitbit, we have Google Glass, what are the implications of these new devices going to be? So it does seem like there is some willingness or, maybe tendency to kind of play out the worst case scenarios here.
And I don't want to get create the false impression that I'm in any way opposed to science fiction that takes place in a dystopian setting. Goodness knows, one of my all-time favorite science fiction novels is Neuromancer. And the world that Gibson posits there is pretty dark, but and yet people manage to do positive things in it. So I don't want to create that idea in people's mind. You mentioned the British television series Black Mirror. Another one that you reference in your article is the Canadian series Orphan Black, which has become quite popular. What's the appeal of these particular shows?
Wow, that's another really good question. To me, I think there is something about kind of the hybrid nature of these shows, the fact that they combine, I think, a kind of realism with these sort of more far-fetched, far-out elements. So, you can kind of get involved in the narrative of, the characters within the show in the same way that you would, watching The Good Wife or Mad Men. But then, there also happens to be, a vast kind of clone conspiracy at work within Orphan Black. So in some ways for people, it may be kind of a gateway show or a gateway kind of opportunity for those that maybe haven't historically been fans of the genre. So I wonder if that could be part of it as well.
Okay. Well, and then our ability to pick up a television series in the middle just by going to Netflix or Hulu or someplace and watching all of the seasons that came before the one where we finally discovered this show, so we don't have to try to figure out the culture of the show and who all the characters are. That certainly is a huge advantage these days.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, I think that the way, obviously, distribution platforms are changing so rapidly, the way we consume media has changed so much. And I think, again, there's something about maybe the kind of vicarious thrill of seeing these kinds of sort of dystopian, techno-pessimist sort of scenarios being played out, but then also feeling the security, of course, of knowing that they're not happening yet or to us. And so it's that same sort of, I think, sense of maybe catharsis that we feel watching a horror movie in a lot of ways.
Okay. And sometimes there seems to be a pretty fine line between those two genres.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I really was thinking about as I was writing this, because I do think there is, maybe always has been within American popular culture, this kind of tendency to sort of juxtapose the kind of seemingly normal with the disruptively strange or horrifying. And that, you can trace that back to, I think, even kind of, 19th century American literature like Poe or Melville, up until, Philip K. Dick or, David Lynch, for instance. So I think that the difference may be that in kind of the more gothic or kind of horror genre, the threat tends to come from the past and not from the future, something that may be returning rather than arriving for the first time. So I do see the genres as doing, I think, some similar kind of work or having similar effects, but that maybe, again, the source of the horror may be the difference.
We have an email from Haley that I wanted to share here. She writes, today's world reminds me of a mashup of Fahrenheit 451, 1984, and Brave New World.
Wow.
I have to confess, as I read that, I thought, yeah, kind of.
Yeah, wow, that's a pretty potent cocktail. I'm not sure if I want to be living in that world. I guess we don't really have any choice, but that's a great description, though.
Yeah, well, you know, we can't go to Mars. You started your article, and I wanted to be sure you brought this up because it's such a great story. You started an article with a reference to the recent film Martian. Would you please tell that story? Because I think our audience would love to hear this.
Yeah, so what happened was I was talking to some friends, and one happened to mention that she had just gone to see The Martian in theaters, and during, you know, the opening credits, people usually kind of talk amongst themselves, and she overheard a woman sort of lean over and whisper her to her companion, you know, this movie is based on a true story. And, you know, it's, on the one hand, sure, a lot of movies these days, you get that kind of, that little announcement at the beginning of the film. But the idea that this viewer could possibly be confused that a story about a human being being stranded on Mars was actually real, on the one hand, it seems laughable. On the other hand, it seems to signal, again, something really interesting, which may be that there is this increasingly porous or increasing lack of distance between, the kind of narratives that we're playing out on screen and the reality that we're actually living.
Well, you know, one of the things, as I read your article, one of the things that kept on kind of poking at the back of my mind, such as it is the idea that here we are in 2016, and we have two simultaneous things happening. One, we seem to be, as a culture, rejecting science and rejecting reason and rejecting rational thought. And at the same time, we assume that things like artificial intelligence and cloning are not only possible, but form the basis for some sort of near-term reality. And I mean, those ideas just kind of, well, they don't go together very well. Why is it that we're willing to accept something on the screen or in a novel that we might reject if we heard about it in a classroom or in a news report?
That's really interesting. I mean, I think on the one hand, it may just reflect the idea that we have a fascination with these ideas. I mean, watching The Martian, for instance, I mean, that is definitely a film that is in some ways much heavier on the science than the fiction. I mean, it almost fetishizes all of the elaborate lengths that the astronaut Mark Watney goes to remain alive, you know, all the kind of agricultural and kind of technical maneuvering that he does. I agree, you know, there's so many narratives that have kind of imagined the singularity as an event that is almost inevitable. And it's something psychologically that's kind of hard to account for. You know, why do we imagine these events as somehow kind of inevitable? And if it were to come to pass in real life, it would be pretty disastrous, I think. So I don't know, again, if it's a way of kind of, playing with, coping with the idea, or trying to, sublimate the fears we have about those things happening. I don't know. It's a good question.
Okay. You know what? I think we'll take a break. It sounds to me like we're having a little bit of a problem with your phone connection. Maybe during this break we can try to reconnect and make it sound better so our audience has an easier time understanding you. We're talking with Elizabeth Alsop, Assistant Professor of English and Film Studies at Western Kentucky University. She wrote an article in a recent edition of The Atlantic about the trend in science fiction to be more like reality than fiction. And we're talking about that today and want to know what you think. And you can, there are a number of ways to get in touch. We've already had some emails. We'll share some more of those after the break. You can also call us 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. talk@wpr.org is the email address, talk@wpr.org. Almost seems a little old school to give the email address. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. 800-642-1234. We'll take some calls, and when we come back, we'll have more of our conversation with Elizabeth Alsop and with you. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about film, not just film, but all of science fiction, and wondering why we're seeing this trend toward, more like reality. Mike, like this, these films and stories are taking place today. This isn't just speculative. This could be something that could happen today or tomorrow afternoon. Wondering why that is. Talking with Elizabeth Alsop, Assistant Professor of English and Film Studies at Western Kentucky University. And with you. We have a lot of callers who want to join in on this topic, as I think we had assumed we would get. Let's start in Madison. And we'll take a call from Bill first. Bill, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Well, thank you. I was wondering if maybe the change... Now, I'm in my 70s. I started reading science fiction back in the early 50s and 60s. And then it was written by a lot of people like Heinlein, Clark, Asimov, Louis Leigh, who were scientists. And then it evolved to kind of a sword and magic kind of a thing, and now it's into a dystopian. And I'm wondering if who's writing it has more to do with the change in science fiction than anything else.
Oh, really, who's writing it, and maybe what their influences were when they grew up. I think that's a great point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking here, again, of a quote I mentioned from William Gibson in the article where he talked about, and this is him talking, he says, I have to figure out what it means to try and write about the future at a time when we are all living in the shadow of at least half a dozen wildly science fiction scenarios. Again, I wonder if, you know, maybe that sensation is amplified if you're someone that, you know, is not a scientist yourself. It seems that, mm-hmm. that sense of you know, being estranged from what's happening could be increased.
Yeah. I grew up reading Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and they're kind of two poles. They're different. I mean, it's and I didn't really think about that so much until I grew up, that how different they really were, and that also kind of reflects some of what's going on today.
Exactly, and that's something I hadn't thought about until I saw again. You know, Margaret Atwood makes that point that they represent really two strains, and she kind of associates Wells with sort of the hard sci-fi strain, and Verne with what she calls sort of speculative fiction. You know, mm-hmm. things that really could happen and actually eventually would come to happen in some cases.
Yeah, and Verne was just amazing with the predictions that he made and the things that actually happened. And we've seen that. Of course, it doesn't always happen in the time frame that the authors suggest. People in the 30s thought we'd be a lot farther advanced by now than we actually are, for example. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, a lot of things in science fiction over the years have actually become reality. And sometimes there's a real chicken and egg argument. Did people get the idea to do this research because somebody did it in science fiction, or you know, was that already an idea that was out there and an author just picked up on it and developed it? It's one of the things that makes reading it and watching it a lot of fun.
And I think it's interesting how again, that Verne strain continues to cite. I heard a contemporary author of a near future World War III novel called Ghost Fleet citing Verne as an influence. So he continues to make an impact.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some more calls here. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Yeah, hi to you and your guest. I'd like to talk about two books and two movies. The two books are 1984 and Fahrenheit 451. Mm-hmm. I'm rereading Fahrenheit 451 now for the fourth time this summer, and each time I read it, there's another little gem in there of, I think, future predictions that have come true. In the book 1984, let's all remember, that was the first book that was put on e-readers, and overnight, people who thought they had bought the book went to sleep, and when they woke up in the morning, this is reality now, when they woke up in the morning, 1984 had been wiped from their e-readers because some conflict with ownership of the copyright or whatever. So I really found that an interesting parallel to that book.
Mm-hmm.
Two movies I want to talk about are both about robots. One is Ex Machina, I think is how it's pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
Truly a stunning movie. It should be watched a couple times to really get the depth of it. I didn't truly understand the ending, but I thought it was fascinating how the robot in that, or the robots in that movie, were getting all this input from social media stuff on the Internet. All that was being dumped into these robots, and truly it's a mind-bending movie. And the second one is kind of a humorous movie, but strangely scary, too. It's a South African movie, and it takes place in South Africa, and it's a military robot. I forget the name of it. It's a quirky name to the movie, and it's the name of the robot. The robot is a killer robot made by the military, and it somehow winds up in the hands of, like, a drug gang in outskirts of, you know, some ghetto in South Africa, and it's one of the most entertaining yet frightening movies about robots, too, to go with Ex Machina. If you want to take out both of them, it'd be two great ones to watch back to back.
I thought that was just a fabulous film. And I thought what was interesting about it, early in the conversation, we talked a little bit about how these narratives often feel like very pessimistic, cautionary tales. But in some ways, it seems like a film like Ex Machina or even Spike Jonze's Her being kind of nonchalant about the possibility that, humanity may be on its way out or being replaced by machines. It's a very different tone than a film like The Terminator or The Terminator franchise or The Matrix franchise that really kind of portrays, humanity's downfall as this kind of tragedy. But I agree. I mean, that film absolutely deserves to be watched many times.
So what's the message of these movies that you describe as being dispassionate about the demise of humanity? I mean, have we resigned ourselves to the idea that the only future we have is some sort of dystopian or apocalyptic one?
I mean, I wonder, maybe. I mean, it does seem as if we've moved from this moment where we were flooded with films like Terminator films, Matrix, Mad Max, TV shows like The Walking Dead. We have books like Hunger Games. The Road, World War Z. Suddenly it's almost as if we're maybe getting to a moment where we've almost come to accept that the apocalypse is inevitable. And so instead we're kind of shifting into a more present moment of kind of pre-apocalypse or, thinking about the thing that it seems like, maybe we're kind of accepted that it's going to come.
So did you just coin a new genre of film, pre-apocalyptic?
In the article, but I'm not sure that I'm the first person to have to imagine someone else has already referred to it, but I'm happy to take credit if no one else steps forward.
Well, you could cite Wisconsin Public Radio then.
There you go.
We have an email from Luke. Here's what Luke has to say. As much as people in power, both government and media, try to reshape public perception with creative manipulation of facts, rewritten history, and outright lies, paired with the public's willingness to blindly accept it, I feel like we're stuck somewhere between Orwell's 1984 and the comedic time travel movie Idiocracy. And I'll throw in Woody Allen's Sleeper to that as well.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder. You brought up Sleeper, which is one of my personal favorite. I do kind of feel there's room for some more humor here, maybe in imagining, maybe a little less doom and gloom, because I think there are definitely there's some comic potential here too, for sure. It's interesting how much 1984 has come up in conversation, and I wonder if that's just because. Of how widely that novel is taught, that becomes a touchstone for everyone, or if it really does continue to resonate with everyone thematically.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're talking about what's going on with science fiction and fantasy these days, particularly the sci-fi movie genre. How has it changed? How is the presentation different? It seems as if we're being presented with stuff that may be true today, might be true tomorrow afternoon, a more realistic scenario. And we've kind of come to accept that we're going to have this future, which may be rather dystopian. And maybe we're just all in a really, really bad mood. I don't know. Anyway, we're talking with Elizabeth Alsup, Assistant Professor of English and Film Studies at Western Kentucky University. And, well, we've got some more phone calls. Let's take those. We'll go to Wausau next and hear what Mike has to say. Mike, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hello. Thank you. I would just like to point out one major thing. When we're trying to observe the world, we have to observe it through subjective eyes. So I have two subjective points to make. Number one, there are two genres involved here, science fiction and fantasy. Now, there used to be science fiction magazines, and there used to be fantasy magazines, and there were magazines that were both science fiction and fantasy. At times, the line would become blurred between the two. You might be observing a re-separation of science fiction and fantasy. And the second point I'd like to make is, we observe the world through the lenses of denial. And perhaps reality is a lot more dystopian than we're willing to admit.
Yeah, I think that latter possibility is definitely a very likely one. I mean, I think that, you know, the fact, again, that one possibility I bring up in the article is that in setting their stories more in a more proximate, recognizable future, that these filmmakers and writers and showrunners may be really trying to underscore the parallels between the kind of, you know, events that they play out and what's going on now, so that they're better able to serve as a kind of social critique and to draw viewer or reader attention to, the more dystopian elements of our current reality. But in terms of genre,
go ahead. No.
In terms of genre, I think it's important to remember, too, that the genre has historically been, both persistent, but also flexible, and it's often most useful as a critical category. So I know there's been a lot of debate about what constitutes science fiction versus speculative fiction versus fantasy. But one of the things I find really interesting is the possibility that the writer Ben Marcus raised in an interview I cited in the article, that we're kind of witnessing almost the collapse of genre, and that, you know, kind of what we tend to think of as literary realism is now increasingly kind of venturing into sci-fi or kind of speculative terrain. So I think that's a possibility to kind of look out for, is maybe that instead of the kind of re-separation of genres, we're actually seeing kind of the conflation of genre a little bit.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm still thinking about what Mike said in his phone call comment, that things may actually be worse than we think they are. Mike, thanks a lot for putting that idea in my head. I needed to hear that today. That was a great comment, though, and Mike, you're probably right. I just hate, I'm in denial about that. Let's take another call at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us next in Appleton. Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'd just like to give a shout out to the work of Philip K. Dick in terms of of an author that exhibited prescience throughout his body of work. And while some of his stuff got made into movies, not too many of them were anywhere near the quality of the book itself. Oddly enough, the one glaring thing that Philip K. Dick missed was the digital revolution. Mm-hmm. So you're in this this dystopian future, but they're still using tape, data storage and stuff. It's kind of hilarious considering how spot on he was in so many ways, especially regarding the human angle.
Yeah, I think his prescience is, you're right, I mean, been confirmed also by just how widely adapted his work has been, continues to be, and I agree, you know, the quality of those adaptations varies, but, I mean, I think, yeah, he gets so much credit, I think, for anticipating so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 800-642-1234. Of course, you know, that Philip K. Dick's use of, you know, technology like tape, well, I mean, they were doing that in Star Trek, I mean, more or less, at the beginning. Sometimes we just can't imagine what will replace the technology we're using, and so we stick with something we know just because we have to put something in. But it's amusing to those of us who watch it later. 800-642-1234. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about science fiction today with Elizabeth Alsop, Assistant Professor of English and Film Studies at Western Kentucky University. And with you, you can reach us by email. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. We had a caller who wasn't able to stay on the line, but said that her favorite film was AI because it was a sweet story, but yet it seemed believable. What do you think?
Interesting. You know, I've actually not seen AI, so I can't really speak to the film. But yeah, I like the idea that there may be room, again, for maybe more reassuring, optimistic, sort of aspirational versions of the future, and that, you know, these imminent technologies don't necessarily have to be totally destructive in their effects. So I could completely understand, you know, having an affinity for that, maybe wanting to see a little bit more of that.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234. We'll go to Sheboygan next, where Mark is with us. Mark, good afternoon. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. One of my favorite novels, and I don't know why, because it And it's also a film, but it's bleak. I guess that'd be my word to describe it. It was Cormac McCarthy's novel, The Road. And anybody who's seen it knows it's not an uplifting film in the least. And I don't know what fuels that pessimism, but I reread that every several years. And actually, I just got off of Amazon this morning, and I saw these bumper stickers. My daughter sent me a photo of one, and I ordered it. And it's red, white, and blue, patriotic election type theme. And it says Giant Meteor 2016, and then below it says
I've seen that one
already. Yeah. They're out there, and I guess they're selling well. So,
oh man,
people must.
Yeah.
I'm going to have one on my car.
The better alternative is a giant meteor. Well, I think I have been maybe quoted as saying in the past that probably the best thing that could happen to mankind at this time involves an asteroid, but I probably shouldn't say that on the radio. Oh, wait, I just did. Mark, thanks. Thanks for that. Thanks for the call and for the chuckle. I appreciate it. But we are in a period of time, Elizabeth Alsop, where we're not necessarily feeling too good about the way things are going.
No, and I think it's easy, and definitely this is certainly beyond the scope of either the article, my expertise to speculate in, you know, in this kind of pop sociological way, but it certainly could probably make an argument for something about, you know, whether this tendency is the product of a kind of post-recession era kind of thinking, the idea that, things are only going to get worse.
Okay, we're going to take another break, and we've got to do a couple of pieces of business here. When we come back, we'll have more of our conversation with Elizabeth Alsop and with you at 800-642-1234. Phone lines are full right now, so this would be a good time to send us an email or a post on Facebook. A line will be opening up shortly at 800-642-1234. Lots of ways to get in touch. We have a lot of people who want to talk about this topic. And, well, that's what we're here for. So we'll have more of that in just a moment. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The director of the Center on National Security joins me at 2 o'clock this afternoon. That's the next hour to talk about her new book, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. The book talks about or examines the issue of war, the war on terror, particularly in the wake of 9/11 and how that led to a decade-long assault on the rule of law, weakening our courts and our Constitution. Karen Greenberg, the author of that book, will be my guest. That's coming up after 2 o'clock this afternoon on The Kathleen Dunn Show. This hour, we're talking about how in popular culture, science fiction stories are starting to look more like the real world than ever before. Elizabeth Alsop is with me, and she is assistant professor of English and film at Western Kentucky University. We have full phone banks. Let's go back to the phones. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Mary, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, don't you think the cinematography of this day and age makes the movie seem more dark and more real? I mean, you have IMAX, you have 3D, you have all these computer-generated everything, that I think that's what helps make this seem more real and more dark.
That's a great point. I do think that certainly can be a factor, although, you certainly, I think, see that in films that are sort of less realistic or possible as well. But I'm thinking also of the importance of, other factors as well, like a film like Her by Spike Jonze. The production design does so much to indicate to us is that some far-flung, distant galaxy, that this is, I think a version of L.A. that, might be maybe, a couple years ahead of where we are right now. So I do think that certainly, new technologies in cinema are important, but so other kind of aspects of filmmaking, mise-en-scene and production design are important as well.
What about the influence of video games? As our caller was talking, it made me think about the fact that, first of all, caveat here, the last video game I played was Super Mario Brothers. But Contra, I played that. The ads that you see for video games online, on television, they're all over the place. Wow, talk about dystopian. It's pretty much bad news all over the place. That seems to be that culture. Does that kind of leak into the rest of the culture as well? Which thing feeds which? It must be pretty tough to determine.
Yeah, we may be back to that sort of chicken and egg query that you brought up before. I think it's so hard to kind of trace the the kind of lines of influence here, because I do think it is sort of convergent at a certain point. And it does seem certainly as if the really kind of like the widespread popularity of Hunger Games books and series, you know, the fact that, you know, they do seem to have a lot of commercial potential, right? So ideas, you know, darkness sells, and, you know, maybe that's going to get more narratives that are similar.
Mm-hmm. Mike is with us next in Madison. Let's go there. Mike, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I do science outreach for a living, and I grew up on a steady diet of Isaac Asimov and Edgar Rice Burroughs and all that stuff. So I love that. I love that in terms of not only helping you think about science, but also in terms of expanding your imagination. And one of the things that I do all the time, I would invite your listeners to do, is there's tons of free online websites like phys.org, phys.org, that you can read about the cutting edge of science and technology, and it's written in articles that the general public can understand, with links to the higher tech white papers if you want to go that far with it. But it's great for giving you ideas about what's coming next in the world. I'll give you a quick example. I just read articles about how they're now looking at researching using DNA to store digital data, because you can store enormous amounts of data in a teeny tiny space, and its DNA has been shown to last for centuries. So it's a way to basically back up all of our data. And so somewhere in the near future, we may all have DNA drives.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Well, that's okay, like I need to visit.
Yeah, that's just one of just every single day I read something new. I go, wow, that technology could change the world. So if someone's out there wanting to write science fiction, I would say start reading that to give ideas for what to use instead of, you know, reel to reel tape machines for data storage.
Yeah. Wow, fascinating. I mean, I do wonder sometimes if, you know, we're almost getting our ideas about science from popular culture, that seems a little bit dangerous sometimes. So it would probably be good to have an antidote that is based in facts.
Well, there you go. And Nathaniel might actually want to give us some hope here this afternoon. He tosses us this life ring. I would point to two very good movies, Moon and Source Code, that are good sci-fi and have a problem characters face but overcome. Also, surviving the apocalypse and rebuilding rather than ending is a theme for some of the other films that we've mentioned previously this afternoon.
Yeah, that's good. That's a great, I think, to add to the kind of maybe small but important corpus of films that don't play out the worst case scenario. I really liked Moon. I saw that one. I have not seen Source Code, but I'll have to add it to my list. I think Gravity might be another one here too, where we at least get some kind of redemptive moment at the end of that film.
And as some of the speculative fiction that we get, you know, over the years, what we've seen is something happens new technologically, and then we find out, that wasn't something that was very good. You referenced a story earlier about that. The other one I was thinking about as I was reading your article was Mark McClellan's book, Upload, because that one involved the DNA comment made me think of it, because Upload involved the actual uploading of someone's intelligence into a human body so that they could continue living, and all of the bad things that happened as a result of that. So, I mean, we get a lot of that.
Yeah, so maybe what we need to do is challenge the listeners to take these scenarios and imagine more maybe positive outcomes for the or applications of the technologies. It's like,
well, you know,
and
that brings up another interesting point, because one of the things we've kind of left out is the fact that the ability to create fictional stories and publish them has absolutely exploded. I mean, anybody can publish. You can have a blog and write stories on it. And share them with anybody who wants to read them. I mean, we can all be science fiction writers these days. So if we want to imagine a brighter future, well, you know, get on your keyboard and start typing.
Absolutely. Or upload your movie to YouTube, right? So
There you go. Yeah, be your own producer. There, hey, anybody can do this, right? Pretty soon they'll be doing it with talk shows. Oh, wait, they already are. here's an email from John, no relation. Let's not forget the dystopia with the Morlocks and the dark future painted in the Time Machine. Or AI, or the series Continuum, etc. It seems the common theme is a battle between the control freaks, the government or some group or corporation, versus people who love freedom. There certainly are some parallels in the world today.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, again, it seems like we tend to imagine, or, you know, the emphasis is always on, you know, the opposition, you know, or the, again, there's some kind of conflict. I think that we could, again, easily reimagine similar scenarios with a less disastrous outcome.
One of the things that I was thinking about as we were discussing this, you know, the pace of technological improvement is is so rapid. I mean, one of the things science fiction writers may be having trouble with is that they can't keep up. It's not so much that they're writing about the near future, it's just that the future is happening and it's exploding all around us, and it's hard to make that big leap.
Exactly. I think that's what that sort of William quote was sort of speaking to, is the idea that, I mean, it's almost as if imagination is being outpaced by reality in some way. And so it does seem like they're in a neck and neck.
Well, with that in mind, what do you think will be the next genre of science fiction?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. That's a tough question. You know, I am really interested to see what I think continues to happen in the wake of some of these more recent films. I do wonder if, you know, success of films like, you know, Mad Max Fury Road and Star Wars The Force Awakens is going to inspire kind of a new generation of sci-fi fans to go back to some of the earlier literature and films, you know, or to, you know, but who knows what's on the horizon.
Mm. Well, let's see. I'm immediately on our horizon is a phone call from Port Washington, where Carol is awaiting to join us. Carol, thanks for being with us on the Kathleen Dunn Show today.
Oh, hello. I've just finished reading The Fifth Wave by Rick Yancey, which is about to be released as a film about an invasion from another planet. And what was interesting to me is Stephen Hawking is quoted in the very beginning as saying, if aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans. And so, you know, that got me thinking, okay, if another civilization comes to the Earth, what will happen? And this author does a wonderful job of sparking the thinking there.
Okay, I'll have to check that out. I haven't actually read that book, but it sounds like, you know, another sort of, you know, entry in a canon of narratives that kind of have imagined the arrival, of course, of alien life. And sometimes it seems like those stories can be sort of metaphors for maybe fears that we have, sort of the xenophobic fears about, you know, others or immigrants arriving. But as you say, that story can also kind of, I think, dramatize the kind of, you know, colonial impulse and the dangers of trying to colonize other planets as well.
Mm-hmm. Carol, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Mark next in Kenosha. Mark, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Go ahead.
I'm surrounded by people.
Good.
Oh, you're surrounded by people. Well, hopefully
they're better now.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, they are. A couple of books and a couple of movies that I've always loved that I wanted to see if your caller, your guest had anything to say about. One is a fairly recent book called Rainbow's End.
Okay.
And then another one, also a dystopian story, an older book called A Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Rainbow's End I'm not familiar with. A Canticle for Leibowitz I have read, not recently. But, yeah, I mean, that's, a classic in many ways. It probably should be better known.
And I believe it was produced as a radio drama right here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, I did see that.
And, yeah, and I think I'll probably blow this, but somebody can correct me later. It won an award. Mark, thanks for the call and for the suggestion. Let's go to Charles in Milwaukee next. Hi, Charles. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if anybody has given any thought to the relatively small amount of science fiction that's written to be humorous.
I think that's I think that's such a missed opportunity. I think we mentioned Sleeper before as a really great example of that. But I don't know, John, if there are others that come to your mind. I'm drawing a blank right now.
Well, you have The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Sure, that's right.
Good night and thanks for all the fish. It took me a long time. I was late to discover that book, and so I had heard that reference in the culture, and I could never figure out where it came from, and then I read it, and then, I get it. Talk about dystopia. I mean, the Earth gets destroyed to make way for a freeway, which is sort of a nice metaphor for things that happen in real life. There's science fiction, and what that reminds me of is that science fiction is often used as a way to talk about things that are happening right now, or to use metaphors and things that we already are familiar with, but put them in unfamiliar situations and show how people deal with them. Please finish your thought.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that is one reason I've been so drawn to Black Mirror, which is both, I'd say at times horrifying, but also pretty mordantly funny. And it does, I think, create space for humor for us to reflect on, I think, both the absurdity of kind of the scenarios that are being imagined and not just the horror of them.
Mm-hmm. And I've been on kind of a Terry Pratchett kick for the last five or six years. And I don't know, he has written some science fiction, but the Discworld series, he kind of makes fun of the laws of physics and the people who practice them. Of course, he makes fun of everything, or made, I should say. He's passed on, but that would be a good one. I mean, it was all about the irony. And about taking a look at the human condition, putting it in a different universe, and then poking fun at it. A lot of what, even William Gibson, though, a lot of the, I wouldn't say he was writing comedy, but there was always a certain ironic edge to some of his early work.
Yeah, I think that's
even
a
Neuromancer.
I think film, obviously the Star Wars franchise isn't a comedy, but I think clearly there's room for joking and I think for comedic elements. I think it's important to emphasize that not everything in even the most recent iteration of this genre is all bleakness.
As we come to the end of the hour here, here's an insight from Bill, who emailed us to say, American authors seem to have been refocused on the YA audience, offering a blurred mix of dystopian sci-fi and fantasy. For over a decade, most of the space operas and classic sci-fi has been coming out of England. I get the impression that this is being driven by the publishing houses. Can you shed any light on this?
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. I mean, I think it's hard to talk. I think because my piece in particular was focused on novels and TV and films, they're all kind of distinct industries. But it does certainly seem that particularly within literature, the YA audience has just exploded in recent years. So I would not be surprised if that was certainly shaping the kinds of stories that were being told.
We mentioned science fiction as comedy. Of course, Mel Brooks famously poked fun at the Star Wars franchise. And there've been other things on that level. And certainly there are funny moments in Star Wars, as you mentioned, in the Star Trek films of various types. And we've kind of paused for comedy even while we're having an adventure. And so there's always that aspect of it. What are you, are there some films that are coming out that, you're really looking forward to in the science fiction genre that, are either more of the same or maybe carve a little bit different path?
Yeah, sure. Well, the one film that I'm most excited about right now, and I doubt that many people would classify it exactly as sci-fi, but it's the film The Lobster, which I think did very well at Cannes and is now, I think, released at least in certain American markets. And it's sort of the scenario it imagines is a world in which, I believe, individuals have a certain set amount of time to find a romantic mate before they risk being turned into an animal of their choosing. So it's certainly a sci-fi scenario with kind of maybe an art house kind of veneer to it. But I'm pretty excited about that one, and I've heard wonderful things.
Well, we'll look forward to it. Elizabeth Alsop, we're out of time. Thanks for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Elizabeth Alsop is Assistant Professor of English and Film at Western Kentucky University. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and a cast of thousands for producing this hour of programming on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network.